Welcome to Cognivolt. Insight, intelligence, and innovation made clear.
What is life? Where did it come from? These timeless questions have drawn thinkers, chemists, and philosophers into one of the most profound scientific debates of all time, the search for life's beginning. In this episode, Cognivolt explores controversies on the origin of life, the classic review by Julie Pierre-Tout of the University of Valencia, published in International Microbiology in 2005. It examines the competing hypotheses, from prebiotic soups and primordial replicators to self-organizing protocells and hydrothermal worlds, and shows how the story of life's birth is as much about philosophy as it is about chemistry. Pierre-Tout begins by redefining what we mean by life. He calls it an autonomous system with open-ended evolutionary capacity. Autonomy, in this context, means the ability to build and maintain one's own structure while exchanging matter and energy with the environment. Open-ended evolution is the capacity to explore new possibilities, to adapt endlessly and diversify. Every living organism, from bacteria to humans, manages two intertwined biographies. The first is individual and metabolic, the cell's self-maintenance, powered by chemical energy. The second is collective and genetic, the transmission of information across generations. The fusion of these two stories, metabolism and heredity, is what makes life possible. But which came first, metabolism or genetics? The answer has divided the scientific community for over a century. The modern search for life's origin began with Alexander Oparin and John Haldane in the 1920s. They proposed that Earth's early atmosphere was chemically reducing, rich in methane, ammonia, and hydrogen. In such a world, electrical storms and ultraviolet light could drive the synthesis of organic molecules, which accumulated in a primordial soup. This idea became testable in 1953, when Stanley Miller and Harold Urey electrified a mixture of early Earth gases and produced amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. Their experiment launched the field of prebiotic chemistry. Subsequent studies showed that not only amino acids but also nucleobases, lipids, and simple sugars could form spontaneously under plausible early Earth or cosmic conditions. Organic matter was even found in meteorites and comets. Yet, synthesis alone does not equal life. Molecules must also organize, concentrate, and persist. Sugars like ribose are fragile, nucleotides are hard to assemble, and many reactions require catalysts. Clays, metal sulfides, and borate minerals have been proposed as stabilizers or polymerization surfaces. Despite this progress, one question remains: where did these first reactions occur? In shallow ponds, icy comets, or deep-sea vents? The deep ocean theory gained traction with the discovery of hydrothermal vents, mineral-rich, high-temperature environments where chemical gradients supply energy. Here, Pierre-Tout revisits the provocative proposal of Günther Watterschöser, who imagined an autotrophic origin of life based not on organic soups, but on inorganic chemistry. In his iron-sulfur world, pyrite formation powered the fixation of carbon dioxide into organic molecules, creating a two-dimensional metabolism on mineral surfaces. This model stands in contrast to Oparin's heterotrophic vision, in which early life consumed pre-existing organics. Both views have merit, and both face problems. The heterotrophic scenario explains simplicity but demands a ready stock of food. The autotrophic model offers self-sufficiency but requires complex catalysts. Perhaps, Pierre-Tout suggests, life's emergence was not a single path but a mosaic, an eclectic origin shaped by multiple environments and reactions working together. Three enduring controversies frame the scientific discussion. 1. Heterotrophic versus autotrophic origins. Did life begin by feeding or by synthesizing? 2. Replicators first versus metabolism first. Did genetics precede metabolism, or the reverse? 3. Early versus late cellularization. Did membranes and compartments appear before heredity or after? These three questions define the intellectual landscape of origin of life research. Heterotrophic versus autotrophic origins. Oparin and Haldane's heterotrophic model assumes that early life began in a chemically rich environment, using simple enzymes to process available organic compounds. In contrast, Watterschöser's autotrophic hypothesis envisions microorganisms that built themselves from scratch, reducing carbon dioxide with energy from minerals like pyrite or hydrogen sulfide. Hydrothermal chemistry provides some support. Modern microbes living near vents still use similar reactions, yet evidence for such pathways on the early Earth remains limited. Replicators or metabolism first? This debate touches the heart of the mystery. Did life start with information or with chemistry? The replicator first school argues that life began when a molecule learned to copy itself. This idea, championed by Manfred Eigen, Leslie Orgel, and Richard Dawkins, leads to the concept of an RNA world, a stage when RNA molecules acted as both catalysts and genes. The discovery of catalytic RNA, or ribozymes, in the 1980s seemed to confirm that a single molecule could handle both roles. But skeptics question how such complex polymers could appear spontaneously. Molecules like RNA require precise sequences, high-energy bonds, and homochiral building blocks. Others, including Christian de Duve, Harold Morowitz, and Stuart Kaufman, advocate a metabolism-first approach. They propose that networks of simple chemical reactions self-organized long before nucleic acids existed. These primitive metabolic cycles could store energy and gradually evolve complexity, eventually giving rise to replicators. Each side accuses the other of missing the essential spark, structure without information versus information without structure. Early or late cellularization? A third controversy concerns when cellular boundaries appeared. Were the first replicators free in solution, or did they evolve inside membranes? Many geneticists favor an acellular start, information floating freely until it found protection. Peartoo and others disagree. They argue that energy transduction, resource control, and identity all require a boundary, a self-sustaining membrane. Without such bioenergetic compartments, chemistry cannot persist. From this view, life was cellular from the beginning, powered by primitive lipid vesicles or mineral surfaces that maintained chemical gradients. In one of the paper's diagrams, Peartoo illustrates these positions as three intersecting axes, a map of life's philosophical crossroads. Each question reshapes how we imagine the first ecosystems. Were they soup-like pools of molecules, iron-sulfur films on rocks, or networks of protocells trading chemicals? Perhaps, he writes, the ecological networks were, from the very beginning, the cradle of evolution. To reconcile these debates, Peartoo adopts a genealogical perspective inspired by Ayres-Sottmary. He distinguishes between units of life, entities capable of self-maintenance, and units of evolution, entities that can replicate and pass on heritable information. Modern cells are both, but in the earliest stages, autonomy may have preceded heredity. In this view, life began with protocells, self-organized molecular assemblies enclosed by membranes, exchanging matter and energy with the environment but lacking genetic instructions. These protocells were autonomous but not yet Darwinian. They maintained themselves but could not yet evolve. Only when a primitive genetic system appeared, perhaps RNA embedded within these protocells, did true evolution begin. Once replication and mutation entered the picture, natural selection could shape complexity. This moment marks the bridge from protobiology to biology. The invention of RNA-based protein synthesis brought the next revolution, the takeover from ribozymes to enzymes. Proteins became the main catalysts, nucleic acids became dedicated to information. Later, DNA replaced RNA as the stable genetic store, completing the canonical triad, DNA, RNA, and protein, that underpins all known life. This, Peartoo concludes, was the dawn of open-ended evolution, a world of true cells, capable of endless variation. The story of life's origin is not linear. It is a web of transitions, from geochemistry to metabolism, from metabolism to heredity, from heredity to evolution. Each step added a new layer of autonomy. For Peartoo, the critical insight is that individual existence preceded collective history. Before evolution could act, there had to be something to evolve, a self-sustaining chemical system connected to its environment. Life, then, was born not from a single molecule but from the interplay of energy, matter, and boundaries. It was ecological before it was genetic. The earliest living systems were not isolated miracles but networks of interacting protocells, each exchanging resources and energy with its surroundings. From these interlinked communities emerged the first true cells, carrying hereditary memory and capable of Darwinian competition. In his closing remarks, Piatu predicts that future research will depend on dialogue between two schools, those who say life began with the first gene, and those who argue that no origin of life model is credible unless it explains how energy flowed through the system. The bridge between them may be experimental, combining catalytic networks, mineral surfaces, and lipid compartments into self-reproducing chemical ecologies. Today, nearly two decades later, synthetic biologists are doing exactly that, creating protocells that grow, divide, and even evolve in the laboratory. Step by step, they are bringing the chemical origins of life closer to observation. Controversies on the origin of life reminds us that the question of how life began is not only a scientific puzzle, but a reflection on what it means to be alive. Between autonomy and evolution, metabolism and information, order and chance, lies the fragile line that separates chemistry from biology, the spark that turned matter into meaning.
You've been listening to Cognivolt, a deeper way to understand the world.